Good evening, everyone. Tonight I'd like to talk about this third part of the Yoibutsu Yobutsu that we just read. And if you weren't here earlier in the day, Stephen Wallace talked about the first section. Was it the first? Mm-hmm. Yes. At that time. And he reported a... he talked a bit about the title and his alternate interpretation. I, too, had a tussle with the title when I first read it, only I thought it was the name of the author, Yoibutsu Yobutsu. Awesome name. And so I thought I would look up a little background information and, you know, hit Google and found out that, no, it was actually the title and that the author was Dogen. So that was my Zen scholarship fail number one. And then as I was considering this piece, Only Buddha and Buddha, was listening to a talk by James Cordova that he had given, I believe, before the Sishin started here at this temple. And someone asked him what was the meaning of the word Tathagata. And so I'm listening to this from home, and I'm mentally, like, raising my hand, you know, oh, I know, call on me. So he answered it as it means the one who thus comes. And I was like, ooh, that isn't what I thought it was. I thought it was the awakened one, which I believe is what Buddha means. But I had not heard of that, the Tathagata, or at least it didn't register in the past, the one who thus comes. And I was really blown away by that definition. And or that translation. I thought how very honest it was. If you're asking the what James Ford has described as the two great spiritual questions, who am I or what is it? What is the most basic observation that you can make about either one of those? Something thus comes. One thus comes, or something thus comes. Either way, Tathagata. So, self coming forth, observing that, wondering about it, and noting as the very basis, the one who thus comes. And wondering about the world all around, at the very basis, that which thus comes, Tathagata and Tathagata, everything Tathagata, the entire universe Tathagata. And so I read this this verse. An ancient Buddha said, "The entire universe is the true human body. The entire universe is the gate of liberation. The entire universe is the eye of Vairochana. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self." It struck me as sort of the cliff notes of Zen Buddhism, all condensed down to these four lines. And I'm sure that each one could be a Dharma talk in itself. The one that really snagged me was the last one. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. Here is, again, talking about the universe and the self. Those two great questions. Who am I? What is it? And it seemed to me that the statement, "The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self," was perhaps a little bit too long. Wasn't not enough to say the entire universe is the Dharma body. Is the self somehow standing outside of that? But if we only say the entire universe is the Dharma body, I suspect that we automatically set ourselves as the one who's observing this, who's standing outside of it. So I'm kind of glad that the self was included in the line. It goes back and forth. Also, I was wondering what this looked like. It occurred to me that I'd had a brush with this Dharma body, obviously I've had lots of brushes with it, but one where I recognized this. Sometimes it takes extraordinary circumstances for us to notice what's right in front of us in a different way. And in this case, it was that I was driving along with my son in the passenger seat. He's grown up, and we were chatting and hadn't seen each other for a while, so we were catching up on the news and driving through a sort of suburban area. And suddenly, there was the windshield in front of me and a great deer's body and a thump and hands turning the steering wheel and an image in the rearview mirror of the deer tumbling over in the air. All of those things hung together as one. Afterwards, my son and I looked at each other and said, "We just hit a deer. It happened so fast." We were astonished. It happened so fast. And that's all we could say over and over. It's as though we couldn't get hold of it in any way with our minds. It had happened too fast. There was no time for any thoughts about it. No time to parse it out. It held together as a whole, the entire incident. And even thinking back on it, there's no way that I could pluck out just the deer and think about it, because the deer and the windshield went together and my image of it in the rear view mirror. There was no way that I could pluck out just the car, because the hands were swerving the steering wheel. And again, the windshield was plastered with this great body. Here was the entire universe at that moment presenting itself as a whole. The one that thus came. So I was holding this up to myself and thinking about it, along with this line, "The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self." And so I gave it a little bit of a turn and wondered, what would it look like if you didn't know this? How would it be on the sort of dark side of it? Not recognizing that this is so. And I remembered a time when, this was a few years ago, but it came immediately to mind when I considered this flip side. There was a young man who lived next door to us. He was just back from his stint in the military, and all his other young friends from his high school days came over to visit with him, and they had a rather raucous party in the backyard, as young men are wont to do. And afterwards, as the evening waned, the party began to break up. His friends left, but there was one who remained behind. He was the last one to go, and it was, he went out to his car, and for some reason he began beeping the horn, and he beeped it over and over and over. And this was summertime, so everybody's windows were open, and we could all hear it, and he wouldn't stop. And I could feel the sort of needles of irritation coming out from my skin and all around, you know, just like, oh, it was such a peaceful evening until this started, this beeping. And finally, the young man who lived next door called out to his friend, "Hey, cut it out. It's too much noise." And the fellow beeping the horn called back, "What do I care? It's not my neighborhood." And he started beeping the horn again. And the same thing happened over, as the fellow who lived next door called out, "Cut it out. It's too much noise." He said, "What do I care? It's not my neighborhood. It's not my neighborhood." And this call of his, that it was not his neighborhood, really reached through to me. I heard it over and over long after he had stopped. And he had certainly emphasized, he'd made sure that we all heard this with the beeping of the horn. He was sending out quite a strong message of alienation, of feeling lost in this world, not in his neighborhood. Who knows where it is? Maybe he didn't have one, had never quite found it. He did not see the universe as the entire universe, as the Dharma body of the self. And it was quite a plaintive cry. It really struck me to the heart. Has stayed with me ever since. So the entire body, the entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. I thought really it needed one more turn to say what this looks like in ordinary life, not in extraordinary circumstances, not when we've forgotten what it is, but how does it just look in our day-to-day life? So many of these beautiful Zen words, they inspire and they uplift. But then I wonder, what does it mean when I'm riding the subway, you know, and it's grungy and I'm tired, and it smells like everyone's sweat? How do I translate this into day-to-day life? And so I thought about this line and what example I could use for this talk that we would all be familiar with. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. And it eluded me for a while, and then suddenly opened up and was quite clear. The example was a young man goes out to his car and he begins to beep the horn. His friend shouts to him, "Cut it out, it's too much noise." And he calls out in return, "What do I care? It's not my neighborhood." And his cries reach through the windows of all the houses in the neighborhood. The trees rustle a little in the evening breeze to comfort him. And the birds chirp a little encouragement. The neighbors hear his cries and react as is suitable for them to react. And he's completely enfolded in his neighborhood that he doesn't see. The earth holds him up. And from the time he was born until the time he dies, he will always be in the midst of that neighborhood. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. Thank you.
Please make yourselves comfortable. We'll have our Dharma dialogue now. And this is where you can come forward with your questions, your observations about the talk, about your practice, about how the Dharma body is your true self.
Yes. Okay, I loved how you helped us reframe that, you know, because when you first explain about the, you know, alienated boy calling out, you know, this isn't my neighborhood. All I could sense into was his alienation, you know. And then when you were able to, you know, turn it and show how, you know, the whole universe there, the neighbors hearing and the earth supporting him, and it's even, you know, when you don't think it there, you know, it's all still there. Like, maybe not in the way you think it is, but it's there, you know. So that was really wonderful way that you did that. So thank you.
Yeah, that it doesn't depend upon the conditions. It doesn't even depend upon our view of it. Mm. It is what it is.
Yeah, it's very vivid. Thank you.
Just reflecting on this term that none of us knew some years ago, and now it is enough to strike terror in your heart, out of network. And that you and the deer were out of network to each other.
I don't know what it refers to.
What does that network mean?
If you go to a medical office that's not part of your planned group, then it's out of network. It costs a lot more than in network. And so, I just, you know, you can kind of envision the whole earth, they're not little networks all over. We don't see Kate and this deer in the same little cubicle of a network, and yet suddenly there you are, just right together. Something that you couldn't anticipate or even really believe after you saw it.
And yet it was clear that it all arose together, of a piece. And it wasn't the deer that had been, I presume, running toward the car, not the same deer that was right there.
Well, and that the image of you two in the car, they're saying, it happened so fast, it happened so fast. Mm-hmm. So poignant about our life, about, you know, these things that can happen to us that change our whole life, you know, and some things are so slow we can't even see them, and some things in an instant, it's happened and we can't even know it hardly.
Mm. Yeah. Could only just say it's what has thus come.
The deer has thus come.
And thus gone.
That's right. Well, that's the other meaning of it. Tathagata is the one who thus comes and the one who thus goes.
Is that true?
Tathagata.
If you add that extra A.
Oh, I love that.
The one thus comes.
Yeah. The one who thus comes and the one who thus goes. And I think originally it referred to a deer.
But it was a deer.
We don't need to differentiate.
Yeah.
Yes.
In that verse that you mentioned, what is the, am I pronouncing it right, the Vairochana.
Oh, it's one of the Buddhas. Can I tell you which one? I'm the two-time fail on the Zen scholarship, so perhaps we should defer to a higher.
Steve knows.
Your Dharmakaya.
Vairochana.
Yeah.
In the meal chant.
That's awesome. Yes. So the Buddha of pure Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is the Dharma body.
When we recite the lineage recitation, we refer to the seven ancient Buddhas, the ones who preceded Shakyamuni Buddha, our historical Buddha. Vairochana is one of them. Pure Dharmakaya, the pure thusness body, teaching body, Dharma body. Also a deer.
These Buddhas should just stay off the road.
I really like that you used a tragic occurrence as an example of oneness. And an annoying occurrence is an example of oneness. Often oneness is fetishized into something wonderful. Blissful. Yeah. So yeah, blissful. Yeah. And of course it's every single occurrence of every single thing in the whole universe is it. But there are these moments that shock us that sometimes are really heart-wrenching. So I really appreciate it.
It seems to be the way that it catches my attention the most.
Well, I think you're not alone there. But usually when our attention is caught that way, we don't go to that wholeness. We block. So that's what practice allows us.
I can't honestly say that I went there. It's more that it presented itself that way. You know, it didn't feel like an intention on my part. It's just how it arose.
Which I think is unusual for most of us. When we're in one of those situations, we tend to go, this is terrible, and make all kinds of separation.
Well, I had lots of that afterwards, especially dealing with the insurance company.
And there you have it.
It's like the wheels start up again.
But you were talking earlier today about the fruits of practice. There is something about this capacity to see the universe unfolding even in the worst places. That we might take for granted, but let's not.
It's good. Yes.
I don't know if this is a right kind of question, but I was wondering about the person that said it's not my neighborhood. You know, that's like, what's the response to that, other than just being and knowing that that person might eventually see that it is their neighborhood? But, I mean, we run into that every day in our lives, people feeling like it's not their neighborhood, whatever, with their actions or, I don't know, so I'm curious about, I mean, is the response just accepting and letting that person just be? And not be aware that it's their neighborhood or where it,
it's a good question.
I'm just kind of curious about that because it reminds me of teenagers, which I'm having a few teenage issues, and it's kind of much like that. So to just let it be and let them understand that their neighborhood, it is their neighborhood, or... I'm just curious. I don't know. Just put it on the table. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And teenagers are a really good alternate way to look at it because it's like if you go toward or away from it, it's wrong either way. You know, like if you confront them with what's going on, it becomes a conflict. And you can't just ignore what they're doing because that's, you know, as parents, we guide, right? And also there may be danger involved if you ignore it. And so what to do? It's a really interesting way to look at it. In the case of this fellow who was beeping the horn, the response that was immediately available to me was to hear it, to receive it. And all too often that is just about the only response that's available to us. So it's really important to do it, this one thing. That we can do. And if we see that there's some other way, then to, you know, attempt that as well. I can't really give you guidance with it. I have a teen at home myself, so I'm working through it as well. But perhaps that's the place to start, just to really hear what it is that they're saying. Sometimes that's all that's needed.
Well, and I think how hard it is to hear that, because I don't want to hear that, you know, that sense of dislocation and the not caring. I mean, it's quite a thing to receive it without running away or shutting down, you know, shutting it down, shutting me down. And And yet all of us know that mm-hmm. feeling, mm-hmm. you know, like, I don't belong here. So that the teenagers, of course, act out what we all know and feel, which makes it especially hard.
But just accepting that pain that that person's expressing, hearing their pain and letting that be,
I think
is and then knowing that that and accepting that will eventually help that person move into some sort of understanding.
Well, we don't know. We don't know if it will help that person, but we can recognize what they're feeling in ourselves, and maybe that will allow us to be more useful. I guess ultimately, that's all we can ever do is work with ourselves, right? If we block off that response, then when there's an opportunity where we can help, we may not be able to move in that direction. Whereas if we've been willing to listen and to receive it, to recognize it in ourselves, then we don't shy away when we see it elsewhere and can help. It's a very important question, yeah.
I think it's significant also that even after his friend, whose return was being celebrated, said, please don't do that. You know, that's not good. He didn't care about that either. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to see, I mean, that maybe some of his reaction was, what do I care if you came back? Everybody came over to your house and, you know, made such a fuss over you. What do I, you're nothing to me. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Because that's really one-on-one personal. And not just, you know, I don't know people who live in these houses around here. It's very hurtful.
In a way, it's one-on-one personal, but in another way, it's not at all personal. Mm-hmm. It's just him responding to his own feelings. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be anyone else who was out there as what he saw as the cause of it. I think it's more often than not the case that it's not really personal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there is this crying out and this acting out we encounter in the world, you know, and it is quite a thing to how do we meet it? And Kate, I love you equivocating because I think it's important there's not something we can do, but this place of the possibility of starting with really. We might even say hearing the cries of the world. Back to this image of Kanzeon, this open-heartedness, which does not mean not to do something. Sometimes very important to do something, but this movement of opening rather than closing. And, right, of course, not just teenagers, and also not just other people. You know, ourselves, when we show up as the resentful, arrogant, you know, I don't care about me, I don't care about you, right? Meeting ourselves in that form.
And there's something so vivid in that story that it makes us want to do something. And that's what we're saying, to just look at that wanting to do something, wanting to fix the situation. This person's suffering. I can help them. And then pausing and turning around and going, what is this part of me that wants to fix the world? You know, that's... with your own teenagers, it's a different story. And it can seem personal, but I also think this is another clue that maybe that even that isn't personal. Maybe they're just, you know, lost in their own solitude. You know. It's so hard to be a teenager. It's so hard to be a person.
Well, and the Uchiyama Roshi said that everything we encounter is ourself, right? So ourself in the form of this is not my neighbor. And that, so you know, then the kindness towards ourselves, we've been talking about this letting be. When all the difficult selves show up, can we not go into fix it mode? oh, well, here's this self. I'll just, yeah, I know what to do now. I'll do X, Y, Z, and I've got my formula.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.